Accession number 19921, Reel 2.
Dick Gledhill, Reel 2. So it's your right ear in which you were deafened.
Yes. Within about, around about half past six, quarter to seven that evening, a truck came, a 30 hundredweight truck that had been sort of altered to take, to use as a small ambulance. There were about four of us who were in the ambulance, and it was a 30 hundredweight truck. However, there were two Indian drivers, and the Indian drivers were instructed to drive due north with us and make for the coast. Don't deviate. Head due north, make for the coastal road. So I thought, God, how many minefields are we going to drive through? I mean, I'd found myself on one or two occasions in a minefield, realising that I was in a minefield, and I thought, how many are we going to drive through to get there? But however, we set off, and it was about a quarter past seven in the evening. Went a shocking journey, really, because we were in agony, in pain. And we finally got to the coastal road at half past five the following morning, which was almost about a 10-hour drive, I would think. When we got to the coast road, he had instructions that when you get to the coast road, you turn right. Don't turn left. If you go left, you go straight to the enemy. Turn right. So I thought, right, which way are we going to turn? So we turned right, and off we went down the coast road. And after about nearly an hour, we came across a forward dressing station, I would call it. It had a Red Cross flying above it, just a few tents, really, that was all it was. Probably about seven or eight tents. So they took us in and treated us as best they could. And then the following morning, I'm trying to remember, was it that night or the following morning, I was moved. I never saw the other three lads again. Although no doubt they did rejoin the battalion. I think I must have been the worst wounded. I never saw them again until we got back to the battalion, but I was taken down to, I think it was Mersmatru, where there was an underground hospital that the Italians had dug out when they occupied the area. Now, this underground hospital, it was a big place, and there were all sorts of nationalities in there. British, New Zealanders, Australians, Germans, Italians. And everybody got the same treatment. There was no differentiation at all. Because if a fellow was a German or an Italian, he didn't get treated. In fact, there was one German I felt very sorry for. He must have had shrapnel in his head, in his brain. And he was screaming murder. Terrible. I felt really sorry for that chap. Even though he was a German, I mean, he couldn't help being a German. You know, that's the way I looked at it. Anyway, we stayed there overnight, and the following morning, I was moved from there onto an hospital train. This hospital train had come up from Egypt, and we were put on the hospital train and taken down into Egypt. And it was quite a good hospital train. There were all white sheets and everything. You know, just like being in hospital, really. And we got into Cairo, and there were ladies there bringing us cups of tea and cakes and things like that. And the train stayed there probably about 2 hours. And then the train set off, and we went down into Egypt in the canal zone. Now, there's a hospital called, I believe it's the First British General Hospital, just on the side of the Suez Canal. And I was taken in there. And I was in there quite a few weeks. And the nurse there, they called her Sister Lee, L-E-A. She came from Wigan. I'll never forget, a smart, marvellous person, lovely person. And she really looked after me in that hospital. She bothered with this ear, the right ear. And I tell her, this is not right at all. She says, no, she said, it won't be, that's the blast. So I was in there quite a few weeks, and then one day she said to me, I'm feeling better personally. She says, now, you'll be going out of here next week. I says, I suppose they'll be wanting beds. She says, yes, that's what it's be. She said, but you aren't fit to go out of here yet, really. She said, you're not. She says, I know that, but she said, I can't do anything, but fair enough. So I left and I rejoined the battalion. I was then ensconced on Ruizat Ridge. And that was on the Alamein line. Now, the very first day that I got to the battalion, we were going into an attack. It was a bit of a new baptism for me again. But I had to face it, obviously. But we were going into this attack to capture higher ground, because we were going to be in a better position if we could occupy the higher ground, which we did, and we recaptured that higher ground. But we were dive-bombed by Stukas straight after tea time, and also the following morning, around about 9 o'clock, 9:30, the following morning, they were dive-bombing with the Stukas. And when you hear a dive-bomber coming down, you think he's aiming for you. Well, really speaking, they were after the transport. You know, they were trying to bomb the transport, but nonetheless, we were down in our trenches, crowded into as small a ball as we could. And then the dive bombers flew off. And that happened both, as I say, in the early evening and the following morning. Now, we stayed on Ruizat Ridge, occupying different positions, until Montgomery took over. General Montgomery at the time, he took over. And we stayed there, so we'd been on the desert for about 6 months, until late-ish September, from April right up to September, nearly 6 months. So we were in this line, and then one day we were told that we would be taken out of the line, and that our division and other divisions that were going to be withdrawn as well were going to be replaced by fresh troops and fresh equipment. Well, all this new equipment we'd never seen before. I mean, you could tell that they were getting ready for the Battle of Alamein. Well, which we weren't in the Battle of Alamein, as it happened, because we'd been on the desert for 6 months, and they withdrew us, and then we were replaced by fresh divisions. Now, after we came out of the line, we stayed there for about, in Egypt, behind the Alamein line, for 2 or 3 weeks. And then we were sent then up into Iraq. We went through Jordan, up into Iraq. And when we got to we stopped outside on Lake Abania, which is near Baghdad. And when we got, a couple of days later, we set off and we went through Baghdad and turned south, about 18 miles south of Baghdad. Now, we did desert training, naturally thinking that we were going to be going back on the desert. And it was with live ammunition and everything, you know, shelling and the lot. Now, we stayed there, we were there over Christmas, and it had its compensations in a way, because they also sent trucks into Baghdad of an evening, if anybody wanted to go to the pictures, or have a meal, if you wanted to buy a meal in one of the cafes, and we did. And anyway, it would be at the back end of April, we got to know that we were moving. And the news was, oh, the battalion's going the division's going home. So we in the signal platoon, yes, we knew. Sometimes we used to get messages that we knew what was happening, going to happen, you see. And I said, yes, but don't forget, this is an Indian division, and this is going home to India. So you'll know where we're going. We did. We got to India, arrived at Bombay.
Whilst you were in Iraq, did you have any contact with civilians?
Well, yes, when we were in Baghdad, we were about 18 miles south of Baghdad, but when we got into Baghdad, probably of an evening, not every evening, but a couple of times a week, probably, they used to run trucks into Baghdad, and we were talking just ordinary to people.
What was their attitude to
us? Well, they didn't seem to worry. No, they were quite happy. Things like that, I never saw any trouble. No, everything seemed all right. And we arrived in Bombay then. And when we arrived, I bought a newspaper. And it was the beginning of May, I think. And it was the day that of the dam busters. It was just then. And we read about the dam busters in Germany. Now, we went on a troop train.
In India.
In India. No, the dam busters in the, yes, in Germany. And then we got on a troop train and we were taken up right up into the Ranchi area, northern India, for jungle training. We were up there, it's a week's journey. I was on the train four times for a week in Germany, in India. And it gets very boring, you know. You just sat there and talking and looking at the scenery. But anyway, we got up into the Ranchi area and we did jungle training. We did mainly jungle training on the morning. But we were fortunate that we could play sport in the afternoon, football or cricket. And we used to have some enjoyable afternoons playing cricket and football. Until round about the beginning of September, we had to pack up and, of course, go up into Burma. So the battalion got packed up and we got on. We were in train then up to, where were we? Toward the Ganges, that's it, and the river Brahmaputra. And we crossed the river Brahmaputra. We had to empty the train, get all the stuff under these paddle boats, paddle steamers, to get across the river. It's a big river, the Ganges and the Brahmaputra. And we got to the other side, and then we got on another train, loaded the train up, and then we went up to Cox's Bazaar, which is in the... it's on the border of Burma and India. Well, we then had to walk. It was then marching. There were one or two trucks, but they were taking the equipment. They weren't bothering about us. We walked. Now, when we got into... we actually weren't in Burma then. We were on the right, on the borders of India and Burma. Well, then we spent... We were moved on to Teknaf Peninsula, Teknaf, Teknaf Peninsula. And we stayed there probably about 3 or 4 weeks. We spent Christmas there.
What were you doing on Teknaf?
Well, training and looking for the Japanese probably attacking across the Teknaf River. There was a river that separated Teknaf from Burma. And we stayed there about 3 or 4 weeks, probably. And then we moved then into Burma. And we took up positions on the Burmese front. And as I recall it, we kept moving, the battalion kept moving from here to there and pushing the Japs back. In fact, our C company captured Mondor, which was one of the first towns, will it? You couldn't call it a town. There was nothing left of it, really. It was ramshackle and all that, you know, and in a terrible state. And the Japanese had occupied it, and our C company captured that town, if you could call it that. I remember Captain French was killed at the time, a very good officer. And we in the signal platoon were laying telephone lines out to all the companies. And we had to, every time the daily moved, we had to reel the lines in and reel them out again to wherever we were going, and we had wireless contact with the companies and all that sort of thing. We had to go on patrols. I went on quite a lot of patrols. In fact, one night, the signal officer said, I want you to lay a line out to D Company. Well, about five of us, we got the cable, and the signal officer said, you'll have plenty of cable there for that. Well, I knew where D Company was, it had been. And we started reeling the line out. We got about halfway there and ran out of telephone line. So two of the lads says, oh, well, we'll go back and get some more telephone line. So we stopped there, brilliant moonlight night, absolutely brilliantly moonlight. And we stayed, and they came back. And just as they came back, there must have been a Japanese patrol. And they started firing on us. So we dived for cover, naturally. There were only five of us. And by the sound of the rifle fire, there must have been about 20 or 30 Japs, probably about 30 Japs attacking us. But fortunately for us, there was a Chong. Now, a Chong is a river. It's an inlet from the sea, as we were on the sea on the coastal part of the Arakan. And it goes winding its way through, and we had to go through this river ourselves, this small Chong, to get to D Company, which meant walking, wading up to here in it.
Sure.
Yeah. Holding your rifles over your heads and trying to reel the line out and what have you. And but anyway, this particular night, when they attacked us, I had a steel drum, an empty steel drum of cable that we'd just emptied. And it was a German drum that we picked up on the desert. A good, strong drum. And when I dashed across the paddy field, I thought I'd better drop down here. And I got behind this drum of cable. And the others were under some paddy buns. That's the wall of a paddy field. They were calling to me, come on, get under here. I thought, I'm not moving from here. I could hear the bullets that were in the ground beside of me. But the thing was, there must have been rotten shots, because not one hit the drum, the iron drum. Now, I couldn't understand why they could see me to that extent, and then I realised that my tin hat, they could see the shiny part of my tin hat from the moon. Brilliant moon, was. So I got my handkerchief out of my pocket, best way as I could. I'm laid full length, and I'm trying to get my handkerchief out of my pocket and cover it over, and I did. And then we stayed there from about, it must have been about, we must have stayed there nearly 2 hours. And then the Japanese stopped firing, and we presumed after a while that they'd gone. So we got up and we came back to Battalion HQ and told the signal officer that we'd run into this Jap patrol. So he said, well, right, get off to bed. He said, and we'll have to do it in the morning, which we did. So we went and relayed this line in the morning to D Company, and that was that. But I went on a number of patrols. And then one tea time, I was relieving a man who was going for his tea, who was on the battalion switchboard. So he said, would you mind if I go get my tea? So I said, yes, off you go, I'll sit on the switchboard, sort of thing. So I hadn't been sat on the switchboard, well, sat by the switchboard waiting for calls coming in and that. And the signal officer said to me, have you had your tea? So I said, no, I haven't, sir. So he said, well, what I want you to do is go get your tea. I'll get you relieved on this switchboard. I want you to get your tea, because I want you to take a wireless set to the guerrilla platoon. So I said, and where is the Guerrilla Platoon, sir? Which I knew they must be out in no man's land, if you could call it that. And they were on a roving commission, probably looking for trouble, and probably attacking Japanese patrols all they bumped into. So I said, right, sir, where is the Guerrilla Platoon? Well, I knew he didn't know. And he just said, somewhere over there. I thought, well, that could be 4 miles.
He hadn't a clue. Moved his finger from left to right.
Well, just like that. Just like that.
From like describing about an arc of
Instead of saying, bridge. Well, you'll see a village so-and-so and they'll probably be there. But he didn't know. Now, I aren't blaming him for not knowing, because they could be roaming about anywhere. So I thought, well, this is a bit of a carry-on, is this? Because I had to have my tea, get the wireless set, get it tuned into HQ, and make our way, because there was another man going to join me with a Bren gun, and this was Henry Ford, the man who lives at Ossett. So when Henry came to the signal platoon, the signal officer saw us both together, so he said, right. I says, do you know where the guerrilla platoon are? So he said, I'm telling you, just over there, he didn't know. So I thought, well, this is a right job. It's going to be dark in an hour, because it was 5:45 when we set off, and it was going to be dark by 7. Because that's there's no twilight in India and places. It just comes quickly. Anyway, we set off across the paddy fields. Now, we knew we'd have to go through D Company to get out into no man's land. So when we got to D Company, I said to Captain Mallinson, is Major Newman about? So I said, no, he's not in the battalion area at present. I said, well, we've got to go to the guerrilla platoon. He said, yes, I know. But he said, you better stay here tonight. Oh, I said, we can't do that, sir. I said, the instructions were that we've got to find the guerrilla platoon. So he said, but the adjutant's rung up. And he says, you've not got to go, you have to stay here. So I said, well, if Captain Armour, who was the adjutant, has rung up, okay. So we settled down, the pair of us, with the signallers. There were three signallers at D Company. And we settled down with those people there. We're laughing and talking on top of the trenches, and there were a few mortar bombs coming over and what have you, grenades and that. But we were used to that sort of thing happening, and we were just laughing and talking still on the top of the trenches and not bothering. And then this sporadic firing got worse. So at the finish, it was about 10:50, I remember it quite well. It was almost dark, and Captain Mallinson called across. He says, you lads over there, he says, it's getting too dangerous for you to be laughing and talking on the top of the trenches. He says, I want you to get undercover. So we said, right, sir. So we got undercover, and within about 5 minutes, the Japs attacked in strength. Now, I thought straight away, it's a good job we didn't get out through D Company. We'd run into, well, I don't know how many, there must have been 200 or 300 Japs by the way they attacked. Well, I straight away switched the wireless set on. And of course, Captain Mallinson had the signallers at D Company's wireless set as well. So I could hear the conversations that were going on. Now, he called for artillery support. Now, our artillery had a task to perform. They called it a task. And the idea was that they fired shells in front of the battalion, in case there was a Japanese attack. So he called for this task. Well, they were firing far too much forward, because the Japs had got inside the where the shells were dropping. So he asked them to reduce the range 100 yards. And I could hear it all on the wireless, and I could hear the artillery officer answering him. And they dropped the range 100 yards, but it was still too far in front. So he asked them to drop it another 100 yards, and the artillery officers started complaining. He said, we're going to be dropping shells onto you people if we aren't careful. He said, you're not. He says, you're far too much in front of our, of where we are, of our positions. So he'd reduced the range 100 yards, and it was still too far in front. So he asked him to drop it another 50, did Captain Mallinson. And then, of course, another argument started, and he would more or less refuse to do it. So, now, Captain Mallinson had been on a gunnery course, so he knew what he was talking about. And he asked him, I'm insisting on you dropping it another 50 yards. So eventually they dropped it another 50 yards. And Captain Mallinson wasn't satisfied even then. He wanted to drop it another 25 yards. This is something I'll never forget. So the artillery officer said, look, he said, if we drop it another 25 yards, the range, there's a chance that we shall be dropping shells onto your positions. So Captain Mallinson said, that is something that we're going to have to put up with. Because he says, your shells are being completely wasted. So they dropped the range 25 yards, and the artillery officer said, well, tell your men to keep their heads down in D Company, for goodness sake. Now, I could hear the guns firing on my wireless set, and I could hear the orders being given out, one, number one battery, number two battery, and three battery, and whatever. And now I was shouting out to the fellas, get your heads down, they're firing. And when the shells came over, you could feel the draft off the shells. You know, your hair were waving and buffing about. And they were so close, and they dropped right among the Japanese. Well, they did break through in a couple of places in D Company, did the Japs, but they were quickly driven back. And we lost one or two men that night. And I remembered it. And the battle went on all night, until the following morning, about 4:30, the Japs must have had enough. So they withdrew. And then about 5:30, a few of us went out to look and to see what was what had happened. We saw scores of Japs dead. There were quite a number of Japs dead.
Any wounded?
Well, I didn't see any wounded. They probably took the wounded with them, which they did, you know. So, I saw a Japanese officer there. He was absolutely immaculate. Not like a scruffy Jap soldier that we used to see. He was absolutely immaculate in joppers, highly polished leg boots. Brown, highly polished. He had a beautiful sword in his on his belt. And I've never seen a fair Jap before, and I've never seen one since. All the Japs I've seen have been black-haired and that. And he had fair hair and a fair beard, a little goatee beard. He looked smart, very smart, but he was dead. And I thought, now, I'd like that sword, and I got hold of it, and then I thought, well, I can't be carrying a sword around in Burma. I shall lose it, somebody will pinch it, probably. I suppose I could have given it to our CO as a memento, but I left it. So I don't know who got that sword off that Japanese officer. And I never really did get to the guerrilla platoon, because I believe that, I think that our battalion commander knew that there was going to be a Jap attack that night. And that's why Captain Armour said, don't let those men go through, because